Every story told has a story of its own.
If I wasn't in this room, what could I say to people so they understand how it feels to be in this room?
She said the words, "I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?"
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Getting you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we take a deeper dive on some of the biggest stories of the past week as told by the reporters covering the news, while also exploring stories that deserve a little bit of an extra examination. I'm Adam Roberts, and thank you, as always, for joining me today. It was first reported in mid-June that the Milwaukee County Transit System planned to enact around 20,000 hours of service reductions this fall amidst seemingly sudden news of a nearly $11 million budget deficit. In the weeks that followed, two high-ranking county transportation officials, including the interim head of MCTS, announced their departures. Data released by the transit system cast a light on the ongoing practice of fare evasion, and the union representing bus drivers and mechanics has voted to authorize a strike. More on that in a moment. Amidst it all, new president and CEO of MCTS, Sandra Kellner, took to the microphone at the County Committee on Transportation and Transit meeting July 9th.
I would first like to apologize for how the information on the service changes was communicated. It is our goal to share information as soon as possible. And in this instance, we did not meet our own standards. And more importantly, we did not meet your expectations.
So let's explore what we've uncovered from analysis of the budget, what is impacting the deficit, and what isn't, as well as what a strike could look like should one occur. And for more on this now, we're joined by county government reporter from Urban Milwaukee, Graham Kilmer. Graham, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we could pick out of a hat and go anywhere with the news that's come out over the last month or so, but let's start with how we got to this particular point on June 17th when that first release was sent out to the media saying we're cutting 20,000 hours of service because we're nearly $11 million in the hole for 2025.
Well, I think the big question that a lot of people would really like to know is how did MCTS get there?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that question has actually really been answered yet. The system has provided a number of metrics now at the most recent County Board Committee on Transportation and Transit meeting. But there hasn't really been a lot of explanation as to how those metrics or trends, as they kept saying during the meeting, led to this position where all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, they're $11 million in the hole.
So let's talk about one of the first metrics that they pointed to at this meeting you and I were at this past week, which is overtime hours. Now, the transit system claims there are workers who won't work 40 hours a week, but they're clocking in overtime. The union pushing back on that at the meeting, saying you're putting us in this position to do so because we're burnt out, we're overworked, and we need time off. Does the overtime argument, in your opinion, hold merit for MCTS here?
That's tough to say. I mean, the system has relied on a lot of overtime for a long time. If you even looked at the data that they shared at the meeting, they're doing high numbers of overtime. Even last year and years before that. A few years ago, I wrote a few pieces about attrition among the drivers, drivers quitting the job.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really was clear then and remains true now is that the job burns people out, and it burns them out because they're working so much. Whether it's overtime or these kind of crazy things they work called split shifts, which is essentially where you work 4 hours in the morning, they give you a little break in the middle, and then you work 4 hours afterwards. You know, I mean, it essentially lengthens the workday despite the break in the middle. And so they can't keep people on. I mean, they have to hire essentially 100 operators every year just to maintain staffing. So the rate of attrition is incredibly high, and I think that overtime is just one piece of that.
County government reporter Graham Kilmer from Urban Milwaukee with us on Reporter's Notebook. All right, we mentioned the union. The story moving forward, obviously with the deficit included, is going to be the status of a possible strike. Now, This past week, a vote was put forth to authorize a strike from the union, and it almost reached 100% vote. It was 98%, I believe. Just because a vote is put forth to authorize a strike, that does not mean that we will see a strike like we did 10 years ago. They referred to it as a work stoppage for 3 days in 2015, but the buses didn't run, so put two and two together.
Yeah, I mean, a strike is actually something that a labor leader doesn't really want to call because
right.
It means that their members aren't working, they're not getting paid. So the ATU has a strike fund, but if they were to do any sort of prolonged work stoppage longer than what they did in 2015, they'd need the International to come in and help their members out with some cash. So I can only speculate as to whether they're prepared for that sort of thing.
They do have a temporary contract through the end of the month for context. So if you take that into consideration, the earliest possible would be maybe around August, just for context for the listener.
Yeah. And you're right. As far as the authorization goes, this is just giving the union leaders a tool. And it is a pretty powerful bargaining chip when they're at the negotiating table with MCTS, because now there is kind of looming over all discussions this threat of labor unrest. Once again, I really think it is worth saying that in all my conversations with the ATU, they don't take striking lightly. It's not something I've really ever gotten the sense that they really want to do it. They really do feel like it is this kind of final straw bargaining chip that they have. And, you know, since 2015, they've authorized a strike during every contract negotiation. And what that speaks to is a breakdown in trust between the rank and file workers who are members of the union and the administration, the management that they're negotiating with. And there are a number of factors that feed into that. I think what it really comes down to is that trust is at an all-time low. I mean, for example, the timing of the release of or the announcement of the budget deficit, union leaders seem particularly convinced at this point that MCTS was trying to use the announcement of the deficit as leverage in contract negotiations. They don't think that deficit was announced in good faith to warn the public and county elected officials. They feel like it was being used against them in the contract negotiations.
Another thing that has come out in the last month, this idea of, in the words of the transit system, rampant fare evasion to the tune of 25% across the system. That timing also came amidst all of this, and we had then the supervisors put forth the resolution demanding some sort of plan be put forth. Is the issue... Do you think the issue is as bad as they say it is, or is it even worse? Because we did hear from the president, Bruce Freeman, of the union, of a driver who hit the button that's on these buses that the drivers will indicate, hey, there's no fare from this person, nearly 100 times in a 5-hour window. That struck me during the meeting.
Yeah, and, once again, I hate to sound like a brokered record, but we don't really know. I don't really know what the truth is right now when it comes to fare evasion. The reality is that the union has been pressing fare evasion as an issue for years. The former president mentioned at the most recent meeting that he was really trying to raise it when they were discussing security a few years ago. And MCTS has always been hesitant to really take it up as a major issue worth addressing. And now suddenly they're facing this deficit and they start feeding this data to supervisors, county elected officials, saying, 25% of riders aren't paying fares. And, that's how you and I and everybody else in the press got whiff of it, is when the supervisors released that press release saying they have these fare evasion numbers. But the reality is that a lot of bus drivers aren't pressing the button when someone gets on and fare evades. And that's for a number of reasons. One of it's futility. They feel like the administration isn't going to address the problem. The other reason is that on a number of buses, the fare evasion button is out of reach. It's on a device called a Clever device, and when the MCTS ordered a number of buses a while back, they placed this device above the driver in the cockpit so that unless you're relatively tall, you can't reach it from your seat.
Sure.
And so that's something union has said for years too, where they're just like, any data you have on fare evasion is incomplete. or it's wrong geographically, because something the drivers will do is 10 people will get on the bus and they'll, you know, they won't press it then. They'll wait until they can stop and just stand up and press it however many times they think they need to press it.
Before I let you go, Graham, I did want to address something that when the story first came to light in mid-June kind of irked me a little bit, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on this. This idea of county supervisors up in arms that the press reported on this before we even knew. Now, I understand that there is a county clause that's a county chapter in their bylaws, if you will, that says if it's $100,000 or more in a deficit for any organization, the supervisors need to know. I understand that, totally fine. But the onus does not fall then on the press to be somehow to blame for you not finding out about this sooner. We're just doing our jobs when we get news that, hey, we're $11 million in the hole, and oh, by the way, 20,000 hours of service is going to be cut. We're going to get that out there regardless of when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first got that press release, I think like a lot of us in the media, it never actually occurred to me that MCTS would announce a nearly $11 million deficit and not even brief, say, the county executive.
Exactly.
The thing, too, is that, I mean, you know, Julie Esch, the former interim CEO of MCTS, I don't think she drafted and released that press release herself. So multiple people, top level people at the agency were probably involved in that, drafting, going over it, finally the release. And apparently at no point did anyone consider, maybe we should tell the electeds.
As it dictates in bylaws that we're supposed to do.
Well, that's actually a county ordinance.
Right.
And that's interesting. I mean, so that ordinance was actually passed by – it was authored by former Supervisor Ryan Clancy. And the intention of the ordinance at the time was he wanted the Sheriff's Department to appear before the board more to discuss their budget deficits. Now, you know, since then, every county department does it now. If they have a deficit that's over $100,000, they go to the board and report it. It's in the ordinances. So – there remains this question, and maybe this is something that, you know, Comptroller Liz Sumner's office will get to in their audit. At what point did the numbers, projections, trends, whatever they want to call it, you know, pop above 100,000?
Mm-hmm.
And did they not know about the ordinance? Did they ignore it? I mean, these are questions worth asking.
And that's what leads us to, as we always love to say, the scathing report that always comes out. County government reporter for Urban Milwaukee, Graham Kilmer, with us on Reporter's Notebook. Great stuff, and obviously a story that is not going anywhere anytime soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ. You're going to notice a theme throughout today's episode of the program. We're talking a lot about finance, and we're talking a lot about budgets. We'll have more on the situation concerning our city's art scene and how finances could impact that in a moment. You just got done hearing our conversation on the MCTS financial situation. Now let's shift over to the city of Milwaukee, because it is July. And if you are in city government, that means one thing. Well, it means several things, but it is budget prep season. The city of Milwaukee this past week, doing what they usually do around this time of year, the mayor, Cavalier Johnson, will hold a big budget open house. The public can come to City Hall in the big rotunda. Everyone's got their charts on display. Here's what we're requesting for the next budget cycle and why. WTMJ's Sean Brenda was at that presentation this week, and let's first break down, before we get into the rough numbers, Sean, the idea of bringing the public in to get a look at how the sausage is made is certainly a thing that people want. They want transparency. Was it a good turnout for the event?
You know, there weren't as many people as I would expect, but a lot of city employees were there with their boards in terms of presenting to the public what needs that they're looking for with this upcoming city budget. Right now, the city is dealing with a $100 million operation gap. So a lot of departments are trying to fight to save programs within their own departments.
So let's talk about that gap for a little bit. What are city officials most concerned about when it comes to that number? Because anytime you hit $100 million anything, it's going to widen some eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously city leaders are concerned about, you know, this $100 million operational gap. But they're hoping that by the end of, you know, November, they have a balanced budget. And with that, there are going to have to be some sacrifices that will be made. Certainly, some programs within certain departments will be slashed back a bit. But the goal for Mayor Cavalier Johnson, he says, is he doesn't want to make any personnel cuts.
We're super early in the process right now, but that's always my goal, is to not have layoffs.
Mayor Johnson speaking there. So let's talk about where the money goes, Sean, because you sent me some of these departmental requests for 2026. And as you may expect, fire and police make up a pretty good piece of this literal pie graph. 36% requested to the department for police and 19% for fire. You talked with Fire Chief Aaron Lipsky. The department's really trying to make some especially hiring gains in the next year.
Yeah, they're trying to add 61 new firefighters to the force, and they're really trying to expand, you know, their coverage area. You know, they're working on trying to gain air apparatuses so, you know, officers can breathe air once they're out of those fires. They're also trying to restore some old firehouses that are in desperate need of some renovations.
I was at the grand reopening earlier this year of Engine Company Number 31, and it was a packed house for that. They get super excited whenever they can open one of these houses again.
I bet. Yeah, absolutely.
One of the other angles to consider with budget talks, as I'm sure you know, Sean, is the federal side of things. Under the new Trump administration, there have been a lot of cuts to federal grants, and that's recognized in these new budget talks for the city, to the tune of $3 million less being expected in 2026 as compared with this year. Obviously, all the departments are going to say, we are the ones in most need of funding, but at the end of the day, compromise and tough decisions have to be made. What are we hearing from individual departments about the federal funding side of this?
You know, federal funding is an extremely important part for some departments within the city of Milwaukee, especially the Public Works Department in terms of the Waterworks Division. You know, they're working on trying to replace all of the lead service lines in the city and, you know, replace them with new different pipes. And large majority of that budget, you know, for the City Waterworks Department, they come from federal grants. And right now they're working on, you know, securing hopefully $22 million from the mayor's office. They actually pay for replacing and, you know, getting rid of those lead service lines.
WTMJ's Sean Brenda with us on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, Sean.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ. Thanks so much for joining us again. It was a busy week in the newsroom of listening to a lot of county committees. You heard our conversation earlier with Urban Milwaukee's Graham Kilmer discussing the county's transit committee meeting over the budget issues at MCTS. Another meeting of note was of the Committee on Parks and Culture. The group met Tuesday and discussed, among other things, moving forward a proposal to restore the Mitchell Park domes. But there was also a discussion on two museums that many people in the Milwaukee County area are quite familiar with, the Villa Terrace on Milwaukee's east side, as well as the Charles Alice Museum downtown. During that conversation, Supervisor Sheldon Wasserman, who chairs the Parks Committee, made a comment that caught my attention.
I think there are going to be some failures in the arts community in Milwaukee, and the money that from those who fail will go to those who survive. At the end of the day, there are going to be winners and there are going to be losers. And I think that we're going to have to pick or choose who the winners are going to be and who the losers are. That's what we've been elected to do. They're either going to vote for us or they're not going to vote for us. And who we pick for winners and losers. But it's coming.
So whenever you hear in no uncertain terms, the dark times, they are a-coming, you have to take pause and think, okay, let's get a gauge on where things currently stand. And for more on this, I'm delighted to be joined by What's on Tap's Sandy Max. You hear weekdays here on WTMJ, as well as Sundays with Libby Collins. Sandy, thanks so much for joining me.
It is my pleasure, because the beat, as it were, of What's on Tap is culture and creativity in Wisconsin and around the world. And our cultural community here in Milwaukee and beyond, throughout the entire state, is important. And with the federal funding being cut, whether it's the NEA and also public radio and television, like so many organizations are experiencing those cuts, that those grants, even if they've already been approved on that level, are not always coming through. And more micro, our actual Milwaukee County and Milwaukee City and surrounding areas, all of these arts organizations they've had to be adaptable since 2020, the pandemic,
sure.
and are still recovering from not being at the levels of attendance since 2020, even 5.5 years later.
So let's start with taking a pulse on where things stand right now in that sense. How are local arts organizations, museums, et cetera, how are they navigating this uncertain future? What are some examples we're seeing?
Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of right-sizing. There's a lot of analysis of how these organizations are spending their money. Brent Hazelton is the artistic director at Milwaukee Chamber Theater, and I had him on as a guest on What's on Tap in the winter of 2024 saying, hey, we need this large capital campaign. I think it was $2 million, or we are not going to be able to continue. And at that time, I was thinking, you know, you can only kind of do this once.
Mm-hmm.
You can't come back next year and say, hey, thanks, everybody, for stepping up during a time of need. And they created a business plan because they knew if you're going to ask people to invest, you've got to show them that you're going to use their money responsibly. And they've got the 4-1 Forward program that they have invested those donations and have built a more sustainable arts organization. They took it very, very seriously. So I think that's an example of creative thinking, being able to evolve and adapt in a challenging financial climate because you've got some long-standing organizations, Skylight Music Theater, in their 66th season now, and they're facing financial difficulties. And you can cut budget on a set design, but, you know, when it comes down to it, there's that math of earned income, which is ticket buying public, and contributed income, which is philanthropy and grants and sponsorships. So finding that model, but Skylight Music Theater is doing a concert called Skylight Rocks with Gary Sinise, the actor, because Gary Sinise is longtime friends with the artistic director at Skylight Music Theater, Michael Unger. So to have Gary Sinise come play a fundraising concert, because not only does Gary believe in veterans, he believes in theater.
I'm glad you mentioned the Skylight Rocks show and the partnership that Michael and vis-a-vis Susan Varela have developed with Gary Sinise over at Skylight. It is interesting, though, because when you think about the pool of resources that you can call upon and say, hey, let's make something happen, that's not the case for every arts organization. They don't always have that pool of people to turn to sometimes, isn't that right?
Right. And but even if you do have those deep connections, like think of the Milwaukee Ballet and Michael Pink, who's been the executive director there over the past 2 decades and has done wonders. But they're under scrutiny now because they're adjusting their costs and not having live music at Milwaukee Ballet performances. Mm-hmm. Is that truly disappointing to someone like me who loves that added human element and the richness that that brings? Yes. Is it a way that Milwaukee Ballet has to evolve in order to survive and hopefully be able to get to a point to be financially flush in 1 to 2 to 5 years so they can reintroduce live music? I wish I had the answers, and I wish we had even more philanthropic, you know, people stepping up to do that. But then again, how many times do you see the same names on so many of our organizations?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we encourage young philanthropists? There's so many different layers of keeping a thriving economy. And I will give you one more good news story that just landed in my inbox on Friday was DanceWorks. And the executive director of DanceWorks started last year. Her name is Julianne Cook. And she sent out a very candid email saying, hey, I walked into basically a perfect storm. We are $300,000 in a deficit by decreased arts funding last year. Some financial instability with one of their key service partners. They have rent, and then they also had flooding in their studio space. But she's a leader and made what she described as, quote, incredibly tough but necessary decisions, end quote. They reduced expenses, restructured some of their partnerships, adjusted pricing, this affects tickets, and made bold moves to right-size our organization for long-term sustainability. And their capital campaign is $35,000, which is not that huge of an ask when you usually see these type of pledge campaigns. Even UPEF is still working hard to get those donations, the fun ride for the arts. But that's not the only way to sustain a culture, of an economic culture here in Milwaukee and beyond.
WTMJ's Sandy Maxey here on What's on Tap, and you're hearing her now on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, Sandy.
Thanks, Adam.
Imagine this for a moment. You're a recently incarcerated individual sent to a Wisconsin prison. As you're facing the prospect of years of confinement, you begin to assess how you will cope mentally with the situation that you're in now. For several inmates, reading books is one of the ways a person can help stay sane while going through a period of being locked up. But a recent deep dive by our next guest reveals that several books and magazines intended for distribution across the Wisconsin prison system never even make it to facilities, and the reason for that may not be the one that you would expect. And so for more on this now, we welcome in contributing writer from Madison Magazine, Jeff Aloisia, who has done a really deep dive on this subject. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
So I want to begin first by exploring what sparked your interest in this situation, because when reading through the piece, you mentioned that you were working at a job for a magazine as an editorial assistant and then received a seemingly basic task that turned into something more. Share a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. I was working at Interview Magazine in New York City. That was probably about, I would say, 2012. And I had a managing editor who was sort of overwhelmed and harried and had a big stack of mail. And she dropped it on my desk and said, basically, these are letters that we've received from incarcerated folks. And can you go through them and just see if there's anything that we need to address? And so in my sort of naivete, I thought, okay, here we go. I rubbed my hands together and thought, you know, there's going to be all kinds of salacious messages here. And what I found instead was that they all sort of contained some version of the same refrain, which was, where is my magazine? You know, I'm a subscriber. I'm not receiving my magazine. I haven't received it. And so I thought, what's going on here? Clearly, these things are being taken before they make it to the recipients. And that really stuck in my head, even, I guess, 13 years later as I was working on this story.
So let's describe a little bit about the kind of censorship that we're talking about here. When people typically think of a book ban, if you will, it usually concerns the content of the written material itself. But what you dug into reveals that there's a different type of censorship that appears to be at play here.
That's right. PEN America has sort of broken prison censorship into two categories. So one is the kind of content censorship that you're describing, and the other is non-content censorship. And so this can be restricting the number of books that an inmate can have. It can be what kinds of books. It can be maybe they're not packaged properly, or they're marked up in the wrong way. And these bans, while seemingly innocuous, can have really detrimental impacts. In this case, in early 2024, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections sort of quietly instituted a ban on all used book donations. Their reasoning was that people were using these used book donations to smuggle drugs into the prisons. And as a result, it was sort of a de facto ban on all books, because if you think about the publishing industry, an independent bookstore or a publisher really doesn't have the funding to be supplying new books to prisons. And so it was sort of a big deal.
That's a great point that you mentioned, because when you think about a business, much less a volunteer organization, the overhead can be so thin. And so you're absolutely right that that's just not something that they can overcome always. Over the course of your research and reporting that you did over several months on this story, what sort of contradictions did you find over the course of reporting from the DOC itself, who, for transparency, you note, did not accept multiple interview requests for the story?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I set out, I really did. I know most people see Madison, they think liberal and progressive, but I really set out to write a fair story and to give the Wisconsin DOC a fair shake. But I found, you know, people ask about takeaways. I think one thing that I found is that as much as prisons are designed to keep people inside, they're also designed to keep the rest of us out. And so the DOC would answer my emails, but they wouldn't address the part where I actually asked for an interview. There were all sorts of contradictions that popped up, though. For example, At one point, they had asked this group, Wisconsin Books to Prisoners, who has been operating for almost 20 years now. They've donated something like 70,000 used books to prisons. And they asked the volunteers there if they used gloves when they handled the books, to which the volunteers told me they had to keep from laughing. And of course, that, I think, stems from this now sort of outdated idea that you can either die or overdose from touching fentanyl, which we know from science is not correct. And so I think the frustration on the part of volunteers was, we're happy to come to the table on this, but let's come to the table with some kind of a common understanding and some agreed upon facts.
So now, Jeff, I want to explore the sort of response that the DOC has taken to this that has taken to the censorship they've rolled out in the last 7 or so years, what they say in your reporting is a good faith practice to increase access to reading materials, that being tablets that prisoners have access to reading materials on. Though for your reporting, can you share a little bit about why that itself doesn't necessarily solve the problem at hand?
Sure. You know, on its face, these tablets do seem like a good idea. It's introducing new technology into the prisons. Each incarcerated person is given their own tablet for free. However, there are a number of issues with this. The tablets, anecdotally, are often slow and buggy, and they're also stocked mainly with public domain titles, which means most of the books in the libraries are over 100 years old. If you think about being in a classroom and using a textbook, you want your textbook to be more recent than 100 years old.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. The other part of this is that the DOC changed tablet providers in 2024. When the incarcerated individuals were first given their tablets, they were told that they would have the music and books and movies that they purchased in perpetuity. But when the tablet provider changed, they had to repurchase those digital files that they already owned. And so it's really, I think, a way of nickel and diming people who are making very little money at their prison jobs.
To that end, about the finances that incarcerated people receive in prison, it's well known that the money you can receive for any job you may have is very, very low. I mean, we're talking double-digit cents below the dollar in some cases. When you were reporting on this story, did you hear from prisoners who sort of felt like they were caught between a wall and a hard place with this, in that the DOC, the prison system, says this thing, and I don't really have much in the way of recourse? Were you picking up on that at all?
Definitely, yeah. You know, often prison jobs are paying something like 18 cents an hour. And I spoke with people who said, I don't want to have to decide between purchasing a new book or purchasing something like a toothbrush. The commissary items are already costing them money. I think the New York Times posted a pretty good piece about a year ago that broke down just how expensive it is to be incarcerated, all of the sort of administrative fees and daily fees and just getting your sort of everyday items. And so when you consider the new price of a book, if you want a new hardback, it often runs something like $35. It's just not realistic.
So then what measures legally are these book donation programs pursuing to try and increase access to these reading materials?
Wisconsin Books to Prisoners and other Books to Prison programs have worked with organizations like the ACLU and Pen America to try to at least put some pressure on the DOCs to loosen up some of these more restrictive practices. And there has been some success there. As of the end of June, Wisconsin Books to Prisoners has just completed what they call phase one of a pilot program at Oak Hill Correctional Institution, which is a minimum security facility here in Dane County. And during that phase, they've sent three packages of books to Oak Hill. And the next step will be being able to send them directly to the incarcerated people who request them. That's a bit of progress, but it feels to me, unfortunately, I think, like maybe two steps back and one step forward.
Jeff, before I let you go today, at the very end of your piece that you've written for Madison Magazine, you included letters that had been written by incarcerated Wisconsinites to this WBTP organization. What were some excerpts from those five pieces that really caught your eye?
I think there's a real desperation among incarcerated people who just want access to books. They want, you know, if, I think I spoke with someone, a guy named Shannon Ross, who runs a nonprofit in Milwaukee called The Community. And he made a really good point, which was that I heard him speak once and he said, we're your neighbors. We're your neighbors now, whether you like it or not. People who are formerly incarcerated are living in your community. And what kind of neighbor do you want? And I think we can talk about the role of rehabilitation with prisons. But these are people just like you and I who want to read. They want to better themselves. They want to learn. And right now, that right is being restricted. And so a lot of the letters to Wisconsin Books to Prisoners were very earnest. They all were very thankful for the services they had provided in the past. And they just want what they see as a fundamental right.
We'll include a link to Jeff's piece on WTMJ.com. It's a fascinating read. I'd highly encourage you to check it out. Jeff Alozzi is a contributing writer for Madison Magazine with us on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.